subconscious mind had been his own addiction, but he could not be sure. He went down into the East Broadway subway station with the endless others. He dropped his $5 piece in the ticket machine, got his ticket, got his train, entered darkness under the river. The dizziness increased in his body and in his mind. To go under a river, there's a strange thing to do, a really weird idea. To cross a river, ford it, wade it, swim it, use boat, ferry, bridge, airplane, to go upriver, to go downriver in the ceaseless renewal and beginning of current, all that makes sense. But in going under a river, something is involved which is in the central meaning of the word perverse. There are roads in the mind and outside it, the mere elaborateness of which shows plainly that to have got into this, a wrong turning must have been taken way back. There were 9 train and truck tunnels under the Willamette, 16 bridges across it, and concrete banks along it for 27 miles. Flood control on both it and its great confluent, the Columbia, a few miles downstream from central Portland, was so highly developed that neither river could rise more than 5 inches, even after the most prolonged torrential rains. The Willamette was a useful element of the environment, like a very large, docile draft animal, harnessed with straps, chains, shafts, saddles, bits, girths, hobbles. If it hadn't been useful, of course, it would have been concreted over, like the hundreds of little creeks and streams that ran in darkness down from the hills of the city under the streets and buildings. But without it, Portland would not have been a port. The ships, the low strings of barges, the big rafts of lumber still came up and down on it. So the trucks and trains and the few private cars had to go over the river or under it. Above the heads of those now riding the GPRT train in the Broadway tunnel were tons of rock and gravel, tons of water running, the piles of wharves and the keels of ocean-going ships, the huge concrete supports of elevated freeway bridges and approaches, a convoy of steamer trucks laden with frozen battery-produced chickens, one jet plane at 34,000 feet, the stars at 4.3-plus light-years. George Orr, pale in the flickering fluorescent glare of the train car in the infrafluvial dark, swayed as he stood holding a swaying steel handle on a strap among 1,000 other souls. He felt the heaviness upon him, the weight bearing down endlessly. He thought, "I am living in a nightmare, from which, from time to time, I wake in sleep." The smash and jostle of people getting off at the Union Station stop knocked this sententious notion out of his mind. He concentrated wholly on keeping hold of the handle on the strap. Still feeling giddy, he was afraid that if he lost hold and had to submit entirely to force, see, he might get sick. The train started up again with a noise evenly compounded of deep abrasive roars and high, piercing screams. The whole GPRT system was only 15 years old, but it had been built late and hastily with inferior materials, during, not before, the crack-up of the private car economy. In fact, the train cars had been built in Detroit, and they lasted like it and sounded like it. A city man and subway rider, Orr did not even hear the appalling noise. His aural nerve endings were in fact considerably dulled in sensitivity, though he was only 30, and in any case the noise was merely the usual background of the nightmare. He was thinking again, having established his claim to the handle of the strap. Ever since he had got interested in the subject perforce, the mind's lack of recall of most dreams had puzzled him. Non-conscious thinking, whether in infancy or in dream, apparently is not available to conscious recall. But was he unconscious during hypnosis? Not at all. Wide awake, until told to sleep. Why could he not remember then? It worried him. He wanted to know what Haber was doing. The first dream this afternoon, for example. Had the doctor merely told him to dream about the horse again? And he himself had added the horse shit, which was embarrassing. Or, if the doctor had specified the horse shit, That was embarrassing in a different way. And perhaps Haber was lucky that he hadn't ended up with a big, brown, steaming pile of manure on the office carpeting. In a sense, of course, he had the picture of the mountain. Orr stood upright as if he had been goosed as the train screamed into Alder Street Station. The mountain, he thought, as 68 people pushed and shoved and scraped past him to the doors. The mountain. He told me to put back the mountain in my dream. So I had the horse put back the mountain. But if he told me to put back the mountain, then he knew it had been there before the horse. He knew. He did see the first dream change reality. He saw the change. He believes me. I am not insane. So great a joy filled Orr that among the 42 persons who had been jamming into the car as he thought these things, the 7 or 8 pressed closest to him felt a slight but definite glow of benevolence or relief. The woman who had failed to get his strap handle away from him felt a blessed surcease of the sharp pain in her corn. The man squashed against him on the left thought suddenly of sunlight. The old man sitting crouched directly in front of him forgot for a little that he was hungry. Orr was not a fast reasoner. In fact, he was not a reasoner. He arrived at ideas the slow way, never skating over the clear, hard ice of logic, nor soaring on the slipstreams of imagination, but slogging, plodding along on the heavy ground of existence. He did not see connections, which is said to be the hallmark of intellect. He felt connections, like a plumber. He was not really a stupid man, but he did not use his brains half as much as he might have done, or half as fast. It was not until he got off the subway at Ross Island Bridge West and had walked up the hill several blocks and taken the elevator 18 floors to his one room, 8.5 by 11 flat, in the 20-story independent income steel and sleazy concrete Corbett condominium, budget living in style downtown, and had put a soybean loaf slice in the infrabake and had taken a beer out of the wall fridge and had stood some while at his window. He paid double for an outside room, looking up at the west hills of Portland, crammed with huge glittering towers, heavy with lights and life, that he thought at last, why didn't Dr. Haber tell me that he knows I dream effectively? He mulled over this a while. He slogged around it, tried to lift it, found it very bulky. He thought, Haber knows now that the mural has changed twice. Why didn't he say anything? He must know I was afraid of being insane. He says he's helping me. It would have helped a lot if he'd told me that he can see what I see, told me that it's not just delusion. He knows now, Orr thought, after a long, slow swallow of beer, that it stopped raining. He didn't go to see, though, when I told him it had. Maybe he was afraid to. That's probably it. He's scared by this whole thing and wants to find out more before he tells me what he really thinks about it. Well, I can't blame him. If he weren't scared of it, that would be the odd thing. But I wonder, once he gets used to the idea, what he'll do. I wonder how he'll stop my dreams, how he'll keep me from changing things. I've got to stop. This is far enough. Far enough. He shook his head and turned away from the bright, life-encrusted hills. Chapter 4. Nothing endures, nothing is precise and certain, except the mind of a pedant. Perfection is the mere repudiation of that ineluctable, marginal inexactitude which is the mysterious, inmost quality of being. H.G. Wells, A Modern Utopia. The law office of Foreman, Esserbeck, Goodhue, and Rudy was in a 1973 automobile parking structure converted to human use. Many of the older buildings of downtown Portland were of this lineage. At one time, indeed, most of downtown Portland had consisted of places to park automobiles. At first, these had mostly been plains of asphalt punctuated by pay booths or parking meters, But as the population went up, so had they. Indeed, the automatic elevator parking structure had been invented in Portland long, long ago, and before the private car strangled in its own exhaust, ramp-style parking buildings had gone up to 15 and 20 stories. Not all these had been torn down since the 80s to make room for high-rise office and apartment buildings. Some had been converted. This one, 209 Southwest Burnside, had smelled of ghostly gasoline fumes. Its cement floors were stained with the excreta of innumerable engines. The wheel prints of the dinosaurs were fossilized in the dust of its echoing walls. All the floors had a curious slant, a skewness due to the basic helical ramp construction of the building. In the offices of Foreman, Esserbeck, Goodhue, and Rudy, one was never entirely convinced that one was standing quite upright. Miss Leelock sat behind the screen of bookcases and files that semi-separated her semi-office from Mr. Pearl's semi-office and thought of herself as a black widow. There she sat, poisonous, hard, shiny, and poisonous, waiting, waiting. And the victim came. A born victim. Hair like a little girl's, brown and fine, little blonde beard, soft white skin like a fish belly, meek, mild, stuttering. Shit, if she stepped on him, he wouldn't even crunch.
Well, I think it's a matter of rights of privacy, sort of, he was saying. Invasion of privacy, I mean. But I'm not sure, that's why I wanted advice.
Well, shoot, said Miss Leelock. The victim could not shoot. His stuttering pipe had dried up. You're under voluntary therapeutic treatment, Miss Leelock said, referring to the note Mr. Esserbeck had sent in previously, for infraction of federal regulations controlling dispensation of medications at auto drugstores.
Yes, if I agree to psychiatric treatment, I won't get prosecuted.
That's the gist of it, yes, the lawyer said dryly. The man struck her as not exactly feeble-minded, but revoltingly simple. She cleared her throat. He cleared his throat. Monkey see, monkey do. Gradually, with a lot of backing and filling, he explained that he was undergoing a therapy which consisted essentially of hypnotically induced sleep and dreaming. He felt that the psychiatrist, by ordering him to dream certain dreams, might be infringing upon his rights of privacy, as defined in the new federal constitution of 1984.
Well, something like this came up last year in Arizona, said Miss Leelock.
Man under VTT tried to sue his therapist for implanting homosexual tendencies in him. Of course, the shrink was simply using standard conditioning techniques, and the plaintiff actually was a terrific repressed homo. He got arrested for trying to bugger a 12-year-old boy in broad daylight in the middle of Phoenix Park, before the case even got to court. He wound up in obligatory therapy in Tehachapi.
Well, what I'm getting at is that you've got to be cautious in making this sort of allegation. Most psychiatrists who get government referrals are cautious men themselves, respectable practitioners. Now, if you can provide any instance, any occurrence that might serve as real evidence, but mere suspicions won't do. In fact, they might land you in obligatory. That's the mental hospital in Linton, or in jail.
Could they maybe just give me another psychiatrist?
Well, not without real cause. The medical school referred you to this Haber, and they're good up there, you know. If you brought a complaint against Haber, the men who heard it as specialists would very likely be med school men, probably the same ones that interviewed you. They won't take a patient's word against a doctor's with no evidence, not in this kind of case.
A mental case, the client said sadly.
Exactly.
He said nothing for a while. At last he raised his eyes to hers, clear, light eyes, a look without anger and without hope. He smiled and said,
"Thank you very much, Miss Leelock. I'm sorry to have wasted your time."
"We'll wait," she said. He might be simple, but he certainly didn't look crazy. He didn't even look neurotic. He just looked desperate.
You don't have to give up quite so easily. I didn't say that you have no case. You say that you do want to get off drugs and that Dr. Haber is giving you a heavier dose of phenobarb now than you were taking on your own. That might warrant investigation, though I strongly doubt it. But defense of rights of privacy is my special line, and I want to know if there's been a breach of privacy. I just said you hadn't told me your case, if you have one. What specifically has this doctor done? If I tell you, the client said with mournful objectivity, you'll think I'm crazy. How do you know I will? Miss Leelock was counter-suggestible, an excellent quality in a lawyer, but she knew she carried it a bit far. If I told you, the client said in the same tone, that some of my dreams exert an influence over reality, and that Dr. Haber has discovered this and is using it, this talent of mine, for ends of his own, without my consent, you'd think I was crazy, wouldn't you? Miss Leelock gazed at him a while, her chin on her hands. Well, go on, she said at last, sharply. He was quite right about what she was thinking, but damned if she was going to admit it. Anyway, so what if he was crazy? What sane person could live in this world and not be crazy? He looked down at his hands for a minute, evidently trying to collect his thoughts. You see, he said, he has this machine, a device like the EEG recorder, but it provides a kind of analysis and feedback of the brain waves. You mean he's a mad scientist with an infernal machine? The client smiled feebly. I make it sound that way. No, I believe that he has a very good reputation as a research scientist, and that he's genuinely dedicated to helping people. I'm sure he doesn't intend any harm to me or anyone. His motives are very high. He encountered the disenchanted gaze of the Black Widow a moment and stuttered. The machine, well, I can't tell you how it works, but anyway, he's using it on me to keep my brain in the D state, as he calls it. That's one term for the kind of special sleep you have when you're dreaming. It's quite different from ordinary sleep. He sends me to sleep hypnotically and then turns this machine on so that I start dreaming at once. One doesn't, usually, or that's how I understand it. The machine makes sure that I dream, and I think it intensifies the dream state, too, and then I dream what he's told me to dream in hypnosis. Well, it sounds like a foolproof method for an old-fashioned psychoanalyst to get dreams to analyze. But instead of that, he's telling you what to dream by hypnotic suggestion. So I assume he's conditioning you via dreams for some reason. Now, it's well established that under hypnotic suggestion, a person can and will do almost anything, whether or not his conscience would permit it in a normal state. That's been known since the middle of the last century, and legally established since Somerville v. Prajansky in 88. Well, do you have any grounds for believing that this doctor has been using hypnosis to suggest that you perform anything dangerous, anything you'd find it morally repugnant to do? The client hesitated. Dangerous, yes, if you accept that a dream can be dangerous, but he doesn't direct me to do anything, only to dream them. Well, are the dreams he suggests morally repugnant to you? He's not an evil man. He means well. What I object to is his using me as an instrument, a means, even if his ends are good. I can't judge him. My own dream had immoral effects. That's why I tried to suppress them with drugs and got into this mess. And I want to get out of it, to get off drugs, to be cured. But he's not curing me. He's encouraging me. After a pause, Miss Leelock said, to do what? To change reality by dreaming that it's different, the client said, doggedly, without hope. Miss Leelock sank the point of her chin between her hands again and stared for a while at the blue clip box on her desk. At the very nadir of her range of vision, she glanced up surreptitiously at the client. There he sat, mild as ever, but she now thought that he certainly wouldn't squash if he stepped on her, nor crunch, nor even crack. He was peculiarly solid. People who come to a lawyer tend to be on the defensive, if not on the offensive. They are, naturally, out for something. A legacy, a property, an injunction, a divorce, a committal, whatever. She could not figure what this fellow, so inoffensive and defenseless, was out for. He made no sense at all, and yet he didn't sound as if he wasn't making sense. All right, she said cautiously. So what's wrong with what he's making your dreams do?
I have no right to change things, nor he to make me do it.
God, he really believed it. He was completely off the deep end, and yet his moral certainty hooked her, as if she were a fish swimming around in the deep end, too. Change things how? What things? Give me an example. She felt no mercy for him, as she should have felt for the sick man, a schiz or paranoid with delusions of manipulating reality. Here was another casualty of these times of ours that try men's souls. As President Myrtle, with his happy faculty for fouling a quotation, had said in his State of the Union message. And here she was being mean to a poor, lousy, bleeding casualty with holes in his brain. But she didn't feel like being kind to him. He could take it.
The cabin, he said, having pondered a little. My second visit to him. He was asking about daydreams, and I told him that sometimes I had daydreams about having a place in the wilderness areas, you know, a place in the country, like in old novels, a place to get away to. Of course, I didn't have one. Who does? But last week, he must have directed me to dream that I did. Because now I do. A 33-year lease cabin on government land, over in the Siusla National Forest near the Neskoan. I rented a bat car and drove over Sunday to see it. It's very nice, but...
Why shouldn't you have a cabin? Is that immoral? Lots of people have been getting into those lotteries for those leases since they opened up some of the wilderness areas from them last year. You're just lucky as hell.
But I didn't have one, he said. Nobody did. The parks and forests were reserved strictly as wilderness. What there is left of them, with camping only around the borders. There were no government lease cabins until last Friday, when I dreamed that there were.
But look, Mr. Orr, I know you know, he said gently.
I know, too, all about how they decided to lease parts of the National Forest last spring. And I applied and got a winning number in the lottery and so on. Only I also know that that was not true until last Friday. And Dr. Haber knows it, too.
Then your dream last Friday, she said, jeering, changed reality retrospectively for the entire state of Oregon and affected a decision in Washington last year and erased everybody's memory but yours and your doctor's. Some dream. Can you remember it?
Yes, he said, morose but firm. It was about the cabin and the creek that's in front of it. I don't expect you to believe all this, Miss Leelock. I don't think even Dr. Haber has really caught on to it yet. He won't wait and get the feel of it. If he did, he might be more cautious about it. You see, it works like this. If he told me, under hypnosis, to dream that there was a pink dog in the room, I'd do it. But the dog couldn't be there so long as pink dogs aren't in the order of nature, aren't part of reality. What would happen is either I'd get a white poodle dyed pink and some plausible reason for its being there, or, if he insisted that it be a genuine pink dog, then my dream would have to change the order of nature to include pink dogs everywhere, since the Pleistocene or whenever dogs first appeared. They would always have come black, brown, yellow, white, and pink. And one of the pink ones would have wandered in from the hall, or would be his collie, or his receptionist's Pekingese or something. Nothing miraculous, nothing unnatural. Each dream covers its tracks completely. There would just be a normal, everyday pink dog when I woke up with a perfectly good reason for being there, and nobody would be aware of anything new except me and him. I keep the two memories of the two realities. So does Dr. Haber. He's there at the moment of change,
and knows what the dream's about. He doesn't admit that he knows, but I know he does. For everybody else, there have always been pink dogs. For me and him, there have and there haven't.
Dual time tracks, alternate universes, Miss Leelock said. Do you see a lot of old late-night TV shows?
No, said the client, almost as dryly as she. I don't ask you to believe this, certainly not without evidence.
Well, thank God. He smiled, almost a laugh. He had a kind face. He looked, for some reason, as if he liked her.
But look, Mr. Orr, how the hell can I get any evidence about your dreams? Particularly if you destroy all the evidence every time you dream by changing everything ever since the Pleistocene.
Can you, he said, suddenly intense, as if hope had come to him, can you, acting as my lawyer, ask to be present at one of my sessions with Dr. Haber, if you were willing?
Well, possibly. It could be managed, if there's good cause. But look, calling in a lawyer as witness in the event of a possible privacy infringement case is going to absolutely wreck your therapist-patient relationship. Not that it sounds like you've got a very good one going, but that's hard to judge from outside. The fact is, you have to trust him, and also, you know, he has to trust you, in a way. If you throw a lawyer at him because you want to get him out of your head, well, what can he do? Presumably he's trying to help you.
Yes, but he's using me for experimental... Or got no further. Miss Leelock had stiffened. The spider had seen at last her prey.
Experimental purposes? Is he?
What? This machine you talked about, is it experimental? Has it HEU approval?
What have you signed? Any releases? Anything beyond the VTT forms and the hypnosis consent form?
Nothing? That sounds like you might have just cause for complaint, Mr. Orr.
You might be able to come observe a session?
Maybe.
The line to follow would be civil rights, of course, not privacy.
You do understand that I'm not trying to get Dr. Haber into trouble, he said, looking worried. I don't want to do that. I know he means well. It's just that I want to be cured, not used.
If his motives are good, and if he's using an experimental device on a human subject, then he should take it quite as a matter of course without resentment. If it's on the level, he won't get into any trouble. I've done jobs like this twice, hired by HEU to do it. Watched a new hypnosis inducer in practice up at the med school. It didn't work, and watched a demonstration of how to induce agoraphobia by suggestion so people will be happy in crowds out at the Institute in Forest Grove. That one worked, but didn't get approved. It came under the brainwashing laws, we decided. Now, I can probably get an HEU order to investigate this thingamy your doctor's using that lets you out of the picture. I don't come on as your lawyer at all. In fact, maybe I don't even know you. I'm an official accredited ACLU observer for HEU. Then, if we don't get anywhere with this, that leaves you and him in the same relationship as before. The only catch is, I've got to get invited to one of your sessions.
I'm the only psychiatric patient he's using the augmenter on, he told me so. He said he's still working on it, perfecting it.
It really is experimental, whatever he's doing to you with it, then.
Good. All right. I'll see what I can do. It'll take a week or more to get the forms through.
He looked distressed.
You won't dream me out of existence this week, Mr. Orr, she said, hearing her chitinous voice clicking her mandibles.
Not willingly, he said with gratitude. No, by God, it wasn't gratitude. It was liking. He liked her. He was a poor, damn crazy psycho on drugs. He would like her. She liked him. She stuck out her brown hand. He met it with a white one, just like that damn button her mother always kept in the bottom of her bead box. SCNN or SNCC or something she'd belonged to way back in the middle of the last century. The black hand and the white hand joined together. Christ.
Chapter 5. When the great way is lost, we get benevolence and righteousness. Lao Tse, 18. Smiling, William Haber strode up the steps of the Oregon Oneirological Institute and through the high, polarized glass doors into the dry cool of the air conditioning. It was only March 24th, and already like a sauna bath outside, but within, all was cool, clean, serene. Marble floor, discreet furniture, reception desk of brushed chrome, well-enameled receptionist. "Good morning, Dr. Haber." In the hall, Atwood passed him, coming from the research wards, red-eyed and tousled from a night of monitoring sleepers' EEGs. The computers did a lot of that now, but there were still times an unprogrammed mind was needed. "Morning, Chief," Atwood mumbled. And from Miss Crouch in his own office, "Good morning, Doctor." He was glad he'd brought Penny Crouch with him when he moved to the office of director of the Institute last year. She was loyal and clever, and a man at the head of a big and complex research institution needs a loyal and clever woman in his outer office. He strode on into the inner sanctum. Dropping briefcase and file folders on the couch, he stretched his arms and then went over, as he always did when he first entered his office, to the window. It was a large corner window looking out east and north over a great sweep of world. The curve of the much-bridged Willamette close in beneath the hills, the city's countless towers high and milky in the spring mist on either side of the river, the suburbs receding out of sight till from their remote outbacks the foothills rose and the mountains, Hood immense yet withdrawn, breeding clouds about her head, going northward, the distant atoms, like a molar tooth, and then the pure cone of St. Helens, from whose long gray sweep of slope still farther northward, a little bald dome stuck out, like a baby looking round its mother's skirt, Mount Rainier. It was an inspiring view. It never failed to inspire Dr. Haber. Besides, after a week's solid rain, barometric pressure was up and the sun was out again, above the river mist. Well aware from 1,000 EEG readings of the links between the pressure of the atmosphere and the heaviness of the mind, he could almost feel his psychosoma being buoyed up by that bright, drying wind. Have to keep that up, keep the climate improving, he thought rapidly, almost surreptitiously. There were several chains of thought formed or forming in his mind simultaneously, and this mental note was not part of any of them. It was quickly made and as quickly filed away in memory, even as he snapped on his desk recorder and began to dictate one of the many letters that the running of a government-connected science research institute entailed. It was hack work, of course, but it had to be done, and he was the man to do it. He did not resent it, though it cut drastically into his own research time. He was in the labs only for 5 or 6 hours a week now, usually, and had only one patient of his own— So, of course, he was supervising the therapy of several others. One patient, however, he did keep. He was a psychiatrist, after all. He had gone into sleep research and oneirology in the first place to find therapeutic applications. He was not interested in detached knowledge, science for science's sake. There was no use learning anything if it was of no use. Relevance was not his touchstone. He would always keep one patient of his own to remind him of that fundamental commitment, to keep him in contact with the human reality of his research in terms of the disturbed personality structure of individual people. For there is nothing important except people. A person is defined solely by the extent of his influence over other people, by the sphere of his interrelationships, and morality is an utterly meaningless term unless defined as the good one does to others, the fulfilling of one's function in the socio-political whole. His current patient, Orr, was coming in at 4 this afternoon, for they had given up the attempt at night sessions, and, as Miss Crouch reminded him at lunchtime, an HEU inspector was going to observe today's session, making sure there was nothing illegal, immoral, unsafe, unkind, etc. about the operation of the augmenter. Goddamn government prying. That was the trouble with success and its concomitants of publicity, public curiosity, professional envy, peer group rivalry. If he'd still been a private researcher, plugging along in the sleep lab at PSU and a second-rate office in Willamette East Tower,
Chances were that nobody would have taken any notice of his augmenter until he decided it was ready to market, and he would have been let alone to refine and perfect the device and its applications. Now, here he was doing the most private and delicate part of his business, psychotherapy, with a disturbed patient, so the government had to send a lawyer, barging in not understanding half of what went on and misunderstanding the rest. The lawyer arrived at 3:45, and Haber came striding into the outer office to greet him, her, it turned out, and to get a friendly, warm impression established right away. It went better if they saw you were unafraid, cooperative, and personally cordial. A lot of doctors let their resentment show when they had an HEU inspector, and those doctors did not get many government grants. It was not altogether easy to be cordial and warm with this lawyer. She snapped and clicked. Heavy brass snap catch on handbag. Heavy copper and brass jewelry that clattered. Clump-heeled shoes. And a huge silver ring with a horribly ugly African mask design. Frowning eyebrows. Hard voice. Clack, clash, snap. In the second 10 seconds, Haber suspected that the whole affair was indeed a mask, as the ring said, a lot of sound and fury signifying timidity. That, however, was none of his business. He would never know the woman behind the mask, and she did not matter, so long as he could make the right impression on Miss Leelock, the lawyer. If it didn't go cordially, at least it didn't go badly. She was competent, had done this kind of thing before, and had done her homework for this particular job. She knew what to ask and how to listen. "This patient, George Orr," she said, "he's not an addict, correct? Is he diagnosed as psychotic or disturbed after 3 weeks' therapy?" "Disturbed, as the health office defines the word. Deeply disturbed and with artificial reality orientations, but improving under current therapy." She had a pocket recorder and was taking all this down. Every 5 seconds, as the law required, the thing went, teep. "Will you describe the therapy you're employing, please? Teep. And explain the role this device plays in it. Don't tell me how it, teep, works, that's in your report, but what it does. Teep, for instance, how does its use differ from the electroson or the TranCap?" "Well, these devices, as you know, generate various low-frequency pulses which stimulate nerve cells in the cerebral cortex. Those signals are what you might call generalized. Their effect on the brain is obtained in a manner basically similar to that of strobe lights at a critical rhythm or an aural stimulus like a drum beat. The augmenter delivers a specific signal, which can be picked up by a specific area. For instance, a subject can be trained to produce alpha rhythm at will, as you know, but the augmenter can induce it without any training, and even when he's in a condition not normally conducive to the alpha rhythm. It feeds a 9-cycle alpha rhythm through appropriately placed electrodes, and within seconds the brain can accept that rhythm and begin producing alpha waves as steadily as a Zen Buddhist in trance. Similarly, and more usefully, any stage of sleep can be induced with its typical cycles and regional activities."
"Will it stimulate the pleasure center or the speech center?"
Oh, the moralistic gleam in an ACLU eye. Whenever that pleasure center bit came up, Haber concealed all irony and irritation and answered with friendly sincerity. "No, it's not like ESB, you see. It's not like electrical stimulation or chemical stimulation of any center. It involves no intrusion on special areas of the brain. It simply induces the entire brain activity to change, to shift into another of its own natural states. It's a bit like a catchy tune that sets your feet tapping. So the brain enters and maintains the condition desired for study or therapy, as long as need be. I called it the augmenter to point up its non-creative function. Nothing is imposed from outside. Sleep induced by the augmenter is precisely, literally, the kind and quality of sleep normal to that particular brain. The difference between it and the electro-sleep machines is like a personal tailor compared to mass-produced suits. The difference between it and electrode implantation is, oh hell, a scalpel to a sledgehammer."
"But how do you make up the stimuli you use? Do you teep record an alpha rhythm, for instance, from one subject to use on another? Teep? He had been evading this point. He did not intend to lie, of course, but